Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Jake Rosenfeld, professor of sociology at Washington University, St. Louis, joins me to break down the myth that the Democratic Party powers have been clinging to, that a majority-minority nation will bring them automatic electoral success.
And Heather Digby-Parton will help me run down the biggest news stories of the week. Hey, don't forget, you can become a member of Ring of Fire by going to rofpodcast.com. When you do, you not only support the show, you get extra content. This week, an interview I did with Robert Mackey, senior reporter at The Intercept, about a crew of video journalists who basically provided the fuel to the right-wing smearing of BLM over the past year. Check it out. Really important story and a little bit controversial. Mackey and The Intercept was attacked by Glenn Greenwald for essentially reporting on these reporters, claiming that they were being outed. Of course, these reporters all show up on right wing television and online streaming, so it's a little bit hard to understand how they were outed, but I talked with Robert Mackey about that. So check it out, rofpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby-Parton from Salon, and of course, her very popular blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, here we are. It is the end of May. We're heading into Memorial Day weekend. And I think we said this on the 100th, the day or the week was that Joe Biden finished his first 100 days, that the next 100 days were really going to be, I don't know, the first 200 days are the new first 100 days, if you will. But I mean, honestly, we were just saying before we started to record together that the next couple of months, this summer, and really, I mean, leading up into September, I mean, that's when we have like a cliff with unemployment and whatnot, although who knows where we're going to be at in terms of the economy and whatnot. But we are now almost exactly 2 months away from the debt ceiling. This week, there were major developments on the sort of, are we going to prosecute the former president front? And, you know, are we going to really reveal how the Mueller investigation really operated? And under what real constraints it did. And simultaneously, that's somewhat related to the refusal of the Republicans. They're basically launching their first filibuster, more or less, of the January 6th commission. And that's going to have implications regarding the infrastructure bill, which they came with a counter off this week. That was, I mean, one of the funniest things I've ever seen, attempted. I mean, it honestly brought a genuine smile to my face, both of one of relief and on some level of just amazement. And we're going to get to all of this, but all of it seems to be headed into the next 60 days. Are going to, which would basically be, I think, around probably the day 200, somewhere around there, more or less, are going to determine, I think, are going to define what the Biden, the first term anyways, maybe his whole term, the administration, could have implications, major implications for 2022. I mean, all of this, you know, because if the filibuster goes, then you're talking about S1 or HR1, the voting bill. You're talking about the PRO Act. And obviously, I don't know if we're going to get, you know, the pristine versions of those. But this is going to be pretty wacky. And then the overlay on that is we seem to be coming out of a pandemic. I think this past week, heard a report that shoppers, however they measure that, at like Macy's and one other major department store is up almost 50%, you know, in within the context of a week than it's been the entire year. There's a lot happening.
Yeah, there's a lot happening. And, you know, the shopping thing doesn't surprise me, because I've always felt like, you know, for all of our discussion of what a religious country America is and how, you know, we prize that above our religiosity, above everything else, our real religion is shopping. And we've been denied that in the way we like to shop, but we've been denied the worship, the ability to go to our church, which is the mall and the store, to go and browse and buy a bunch of stuff for a year. So I'm not surprised about that at all. And I think it does portend, you know, I mean, I've thought for a long time that it's highly likely. And, you know, I don't want to make any predictions, because, you know, nobody should make predictions about the economy, but it does appear that there's a lot of pent up energy in our culture after a year of this. Some of it probably positive. There's like that, where we're probably going to boost the economy with some, you know, strong consumer spending and what have you. And there's also a lot of negative that's out there in our culture, which we're seeing a rise again in violence. We had a mass shooting yesterday. That was just one of many that we've seen as the country comes out of its, you know, sort of self-imposed and government-imposed lockdowns. And so I think we're in for a long, hot summer. Culturally, politically, I think it's going to be just nuclear, because what we're seeing is, you know, a true clash. And we, like we said on the anniversary, I think, of the 100 days, you and I think we talked right around then, and we were talking about this second 100 days. The first 100 days, as we said at the time, is, you know, that's the time when they usually strike while the iron is hot, right? They get in there, they do their thing, they get their most important legislation out, especially if there's a big crisis. And the Biden administration did that. It took them a little longer than we thought, probably, to get the COVID relief bill through, but they did get it through. And it was excusable, because they had they didn't really have a transition. So it was hard for them to kind of get up and running. So that's always the easy thing. And it's not just because it's the middle of a crisis. It's because the other side is back on its heels.
Yep.
The opposition, you know, and after January 6th and after, you know, Trump's temper tantrum that went on for months about the election, the Republican Party, the Congressional Republican Caucus, was discombobulated. They weren't quite sure which way things were going to go. They didn't know what Trump was doing, and they had to make sure that, you know, he was appeased. So all of that, they were sort of at sixes and sevens, and that has all settled out. We can see now exactly what they're doing. Mitch McConnell said it, and this is totally predictable. You and I have totally predicted it months and months ago, that his approach would be total obstruction, which it is, and that, you know, they were going to try to finesse this, you know, the fealty of their voters to Donald Trump and his power within the Congress and within the party itself, and their need to try and, you know, kind of get beyond that. It's very difficult, but they've made that decision that they're just going to go with Donald Trump, and they're going to try and pretend like going with Donald Trump is a form of substance. And what that really means is opposing Democrats and everything. There will be no bipartisanship, of course. We knew that going in. And they are going to pretend like that isn't about Donald Trump, and that this is something they're opposed to, this, you know, agenda of this socialist agenda of the Democrats. So we're coming up against all those things that you just mentioned, the you know, all this legislation, some of it coming up in the fall is must pass. You've got debt ceiling and all that.
Debt ceiling is July 31st, I believe.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, I mean, we've got some major things, and these are all moving parts with various players in there, with Republicans. You've got, you know, I mean, Mitch McConnell said today that, or it was reported today by CNN, that he went to each of his members and said, as a personal favor to me, I would like you to vote against the January 6th commission. And I think that, I don't think he cares about that. I mean, he hates Donald Trump. You know, he doesn't care about him. But he, I'm not even sure that he thinks the January 6th commission will hurt them in 2022. I mean, he may think that. I don't know why, but, you know, they all seem to feel like that's a real killer, or they're saying that as an excuse to appease Donald Trump. But what he really wants is to have a solid wall of opposition to everything that Joe Biden and the Democrats want to do. And I think that this is a first step, that he's got to exert his power right now and say, this is my caucus, this is my Republican Senate, and we're going to stop them. And I think he feels that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who pathetically wrote a letter this week saying, gosh, my Republican colleagues, we really would like you to vote for this January 6th commission. How could you not do it? It's so important. You know, I mean, give me a break. So, you know, this is where we're at, and it's going to get worse and worse. I shouldn't say worse and worse. I don't know if it's going to get worse or better. We can't really predict. It's going to be volatile. It's going to be turbulent. And I think everybody just better fasten their seatbelts over the next couple of months, because it's going to be something else.
Well, let's talk about this sort of that type of timeline. And I want to touch on a piece that you wrote about, you know, the sort of the criminal activity, because it's in the background, right? I mean, I think the idea with the January 6th commission, I don't think it's just about McConnell showing obstruction for the sake of obstruction. I do think that's helpful. I do think that there is, I think he is worried. I think he is worried about Donald Trump, you know, working against Republicans in the midterms. I think that's part of it.
Sure.
But I also think he's worried about an ongoing investigation that will be a rolling, at least like cultural and political indictment of Donald Trump, that that Republicans will be, you know, forced to comment on over the course of the next 2 years. I think he just doesn't want that sideshow, because they can't win that show. They can't win that in any way. And so I think that's why he doesn't want it to be a commission that he won't be able to say, like, this is just about politics.
Right.
If it's a bipartisan commission, it becomes a problem. If it's just like a special commission, he can at least say it's just about politics, and they can have that sort of classic conservative sense of aggrievement. Look at this, how it's politicized, et cetera, et cetera. And he knows that Donald Trump will be out there saying this is all a political witch hunt. Right. Because, I mean, if you feel uncomfortable predicting anything, that's the one thing that you wouldn't have to feel uncomfortable about predicting. That's what Donald Trump is going to be saying. It's a witch hunt. What's interesting, though, you know, Ryan Grimm wrote out something that came from his conversations with Adam Gentleson, who is a former Harry Reid staffer, and wrote a great book. We spoke to him on the Majority Report about the filibuster. And he basically said, look, there's a three act play that's going here. One, the first act is get the idea out there about filibuster reform. And it's out there. I mean, to the point where even Manchin at one point entertained the idea, he sort of walked it back, but, you know, he was dancing with it. And then act two is you get legislation that compels or becomes the sort of the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of the argument for the need for filibuster reform. There's a lot of people who are speculating that this commission could be that. And if it's not this commission, then it could be the debt ceiling, right? Because Joe Manchin came out today and was like, I really am shocked that there are no Republicans who will support this. And now look, folks, this is all kabuki theater.
Right.
It is all part of Joe Manchin's, you know, branding exercise. And he needs to be distraught, left at the altar, whatever, however you can just keep going on with the metaphors. But he basically needs to say, like, you know what? My bridegroom never showed up.
Right.
And I was prepared to tie the knot and they never showed up. And now I've got to go through this alone. I mean, this is the play. And what we've seen from Joe Biden over the past week and a half, taking the infrastructure bill, this is the first tranche of the infrastructure bill, $2.3 trillion, took it down to $1.75 trillion, signaled he would take it down to $1 trillion. And the Republicans came out Thursday. We're recording it actually today, Thursday, came out this morning and said, yeah, we'll do $1 trillion. But if you read the next line, it says about 800 of that is coming from existing planned expenditures, or we're stealing from expenditures on COVID relief. So they basically, the initial offer from Biden was $2.3 trillion, and their ultimate offer is $230 billion. I mean, that is like, I love this $500,000 house. Will you take $50,000 for it?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a sweet car, 25 grand. What about 2,500? Would you take that? And there's no room for Manchin to even pretend. And on some level, like, look, this is just an analysis of what's happened so far. The actions we will see over the next 60 days, and that's sort of the point, will really give us a sense of like who was being completely disingenuous, who was being somewhat disingenuous, who was hoping this would all fail and whatnot. But it's, I mean, look, Joe Biden doesn't want to take a loss on this. And it's really, we can blame Joe Manchin all we want, but at the end of the day, it's Joe Biden wanted the job and he said that he could handle it. And he said that, you know, I distinctly remember him saying 6 months after Donald Trump leaves, you'll see those Republicans will come around. Got some bad news for everybody. It is now days away from the sixth month that since Donald Trump not only lost, I mean, we could have calculated that from now, but lost in his attempt to have an insurrection on January 6th. So we're getting, you know, however you want to measure that, that 6 month deadline is going to pass. I wonder how many people are going to point it out that Joe Biden had said that. I imagine Joe Biden remembers that he said that.
Yeah.
I imagine people in the White House remember that. So, you know, one way to assess what Joe Biden is doing right now is he's being completely weak and falling into the trap that the Obama administration did. Or the other way of assessing it is, we saw a week and a half ago, you already had Schumer meeting with the parliamentarian. They're talking about reconciliation. Yes. I mean, what I would also like to see is what we saw in 2001 over the summer, where the Republicans fired their parliamentarian if they didn't get what they wanted out of it. And Joe Biden, this is really not about the Republicans whatsoever. This is really about, I'm going to give Joe Manchin an off-ramp. And that off-ramp is going to be, I'm willing to drop my offer, initial offer, down by half. And the Republicans went from, I think the initial number that Shelley Moore Capito put out there was like $600 or $700 billion. Yeah. Somebody had asked her, why did you say that? Because it sounds like a good number. And their final offer is $230 billion. And that's a pretty soft off ramp. For plus, you put that with the Capitol insurrection, you know, the January 6th commission filibuster, and there's an off ramp for Joe Manchin. I mean, he can maintain his narrative. He'll have to kill something to make it, you know, to even out a little bit for his, you know, sort of brand of being, you know, the maverick in the Democratic Party and making, you know, maybe they can get AOC to come and protest his office. And so he would feel good about that. Like, yeah, I got, you know, these liberal socialists are mad at me, and that's
get
good.
Get the whole squad in there, you know, just pounding on the door, doing a full Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think that's a good idea.
Honestly, I mean, that would be Joe Manchin's, that would be the thing that would, you know, help Joe Manchin there. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, look how angry I got those crazy socialists. And I don't frankly care about any of that as long as we get, you know, the spending that we desperately need in this country, not just in terms of like, you know, from a crisis standpoint, but like the long crisis that we are in outside of COVID. And then all of this is sort of like, you know, the January 6th thing becomes even more, I think, problematic for the Republicans as this legal stuff that you wrote about this week tell us a little bit about what happened this week. I think people may have missed it, some of it.
There was a ton of stuff that came out this week in terms of Donald Trump's personal legal problems and some extensions of some legal problems that were, you know, going back a few years. I mean, the Department of Justice released some documents at the you know order of a federal judge, Amy Jackson Berman, who has been who's been presiding over many of these cases that had to do with the Russia investigation and various other things. And she was apparently very hot under the collar when she saw one of the redacted documents, which was the memo that told that William Barr, the former attorney general, used to justify his coming out ahead of time and saying that there was no obstruction, no collusion, and that he would not, in any case, he did not believe that Donald Trump had committed obstruction of justice. So she looked at the memo that she saw the whole memo and she said, this is outrageous. You've got to release this. And this came with a Freedom of Information Act request. And she said, you've got to release it. Well, the Department of Justice came out and said, well, we'll release the first page and a half of it, but we're going to appeal your decision, which kind of shocked people because I think that everybody assumed that the Merrick Garland Justice Department was going to be transparent about all this stuff. So it's a little concerning that they didn't. But what we know about that memo is that this is a very, very political document. It had very little legal reasoning in it. And it was basically helping Barr spin the Mueller report the way he wanted to do it, which is not the job of the Justice Department. And Merrick Garland and his office said, well, you know, it wasn't the best memo and we don't really, you know, we think it could have been done. The job could have been done better, but we don't really think it needs to be released. This is, you know, private discussions among prosecutors. Now, of course, most of the people involved were not prosecutors. So, you know, it was just some political appointees that were in there. So that's one thing. And that is still going to go up the ladder. It will go to the Court of Appeals and we may see it in the end, but it just kind of brought up all this stuff at the same time that there was another document that she also released, which was about Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman, who of course was convicted and then Donald Trump pardoned him. But in the plea that he did at one point, he was going to plead out and then he withdrew it. And actually went to jail until Donald Trump, you know, on Twitter said, I promise to pardon you, basically. And so he waited it out. And in that, it said very clearly that Manafort knew when he was giving those documents to Konstantin Kilimnik, who was essentially a Russian agent operating, you know, at the behest of the Kremlin. He was a Russian-Ukrainian who had worked with Manafort for a long time. He gave him polling data that was, you know, highly sensitive at the same time that the Russians were playing their game, as you recall, you know, trying to sabotage the election in 2016. So it turns out Manafort knew exactly what he was doing, which means that the Trump campaign did collude with the Russian government. That did happen. They conspired together. And
let me be clear here. You're saying that the campaign manager functioning with campaign materials constitutes the campaign in some way?
I know that sounds crazy. And of course, poor little Donald Trump had no idea what was going on. And he's innocent as the day he was born. And, you know, how can it be his responsibility that his campaign chairman was colluding with agents of the Russian government to sabotage his opponent? I mean, I just don't see how he can be held liable for that. Which brings us to the big story, the legal story this week, which is that the Manhattan DA, who is working alongside the New York Attorney General, opened a special grand jury into all this stuff with the Trump Organization. And that, according to prosecutors that I read and saw, that's kind of a big deal because it means that they would not do that just to go on a fishing expedition. They do that sort of thing when they're at a point where they need to get witnesses on the record in order to possibly bring an indictment. They're that close. And that's quite meaningful because we know that they've been pressing Alan Weisselberg, who is the Trump Organization CFO and the guy who knows where everybody is buried. And they've been pressing him and his family, who is also involved in the Trump Organization. His sons are, so they're implicated as well. There's all this tax fraud, and they brought in this kind of heavy hitter mafia prosecutor who came in, and apparently he has a lot of experience doing this kind of forensic analysis of, you know, very complex financial dealings. So they've been doing that. And one of the most interesting things I heard about that was that the minute they got the tax returns, which was just happened a couple of months ago, they said, you know, the case that had withheld them was over. Trump's out of office. They have to turn it over. They got a hold of those IRS documents. And at that point, everything went into overdrive. They'd been kind of plodding along, waiting for that, apparently. And then boom. And I don't know if it was just that they were looking for some kind, they knew what had happened and they just needed the documents to sort of back up their assumptions, which is a possibility, or whether or not it revealed something that they didn't know already. But they hired this guy, I guess his name is Pomerantz, a former prosecutor. And he came in and apparently it just jumpstarted the prosecution. The New York AG came in on it and announced, of course, a couple of weeks ago that this was now a criminal investigation. That's huge. And all the reporting says that the Trump people are really nervous about this, that this is something that could really, and it could damage the kids and the family, and there could be some real financial repercussions. And Trump isn't happy about it, but he's doing something which I think is very clever, and it was something he was planning to do all along because he knew he was going to be vulnerable if he left office. One of the main reasons why he's refused to accept the results of the election, big part of it's ego, of course, because he can't ever admit he loses anything. But a big part of it is that he wants to frame everything as being a political witch hunt.
Right.
And if he is running or anticipating running, he can claim that this is just the Democrats out to stop him from running again. It will help him raise money for his campaign, and it gives him an excuse. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Department of Justice, they do this all the time, is reluctant to go too far and go, you know, look in the rearview mirror, and, you know, we want to look forward, not backwards, and all that stuff, because they're, you know, they don't want to be called, you know, partisan, and they don't want to politicize. And I just don't even understand it because it doesn't work.
It doesn't work that way. Anyway. It does not work that way.
No.
And just to be clear on that memo about the bar, what that whole thing worked, reminded me of, because I think one of the quotes coming from the memo, made it clear that the memo, which Barr claims was the basis of his decision, was actually made the point that the memo itself was developed with Barr's input.
Right.
So this was that dynamic that Dick Cheney had when I can't remember her name now, the reporter at the New York Times. Judy Miller. Cheney's office leaks to Judy Miller that there's evidence of weapons of mass destruction. Cheney then goes on to, I think it was Meet the Press, and said, this isn't me talking about weapons of mass destruction. The New York Times talking about it. That's essentially what Barr said.
Yeah.
Barr said, look, I'm going by the Office of Legal Counsel's memo advice that he is not guilty of obstruction. So that's what basically the basis of my decision is. I'm just not telling you that the basis of their advice was my decision before it was made, essentially.
Right.
And yes, I think that is what the DOJ is responding to. And I will say this. It is exactly the same reasoning that that James Comey had when he came out with the fact that they were going back in and investigating Hillary Clinton, because he was afraid that they would be seen as political if they ended up going after Donald Trump once Hillary Clinton won. I mean, they've got to stop trying to, the problem with these people is ultimately, and this is them in the best light, they think they are operating at such a higher plane than the rest of us that they are constantly outsmarting themselves. And I am not someone who has an issue with people who are smarty pants or whatnot. It's just do what is right in this situation. Right. Stop trying to engineer what you think the perception of people and how these things are going to be received. Because the bottom line is, if the process was corrupted, it is the Department of Justice's responsibility to be as transparent as possible about what the prior administration did. They made this mistake when Obama came in. They're making it again. I don't care what their reason is. It's foolish. But unfortunately, we're out of time. But I have a feeling we're going to be talking about a lot about this over the next 8 weeks, maybe into the fall. But buckle up, like Heather said at the beginning of this, this is going to be very possible a nuclear summer in a lot of different ways.
Absolutely.
Heather Parton, as always, much appreciated. Folks can go read your pieces at salon.com this week. Really fantastic.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We've been told for decades that America is trending towards a majority-minority nation. This provided a hope for the Democratic Party that soon majority white Republican voters would not be so dominant in electoral politics. But this view is not just a little bit arrogant, it is also not necessarily true. Here to explore this is Jake Rosenfeld, professor of sociology at Washington University, St. Louis, and author of You're Paid What You're Worth and Other Myths of the Modern Economy. Welcome to the show, Jake.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So you open your piece in Dissent magazine, which is entitled Majority-Minority Myths, by talking about the introduction of this concept into the political discourse that, you know, soon all of the Democratic Party's problems would be solved because the demographics in the country would be changing. There's truth in the very surface of that, but I'm just hoping you could take us through that introduction, starting with, as you write, Bill Clinton in the late 90s.
Sure. Yeah. So this is a hypothesis, the hypothesis that within a decade or so, this will be a majority minority nation that now dates back about a quarter century, at least in the kind of political realm. And as I try to outline in the piece, I think there are about at least three major problems with the hypothesis. The first is, and this is clear and it's kind of come through with a number of really kind of high quality studies, is that technically speaking, even mentioning this demographic shift tends to freak a lot of white people out and turn some of them into reactionary bigots who then vote on their racial resentments, their fears of demographic decline. And reactionary bigots tend not to support progressive causes or candidates. I think more generally, the research is pretty clear that, again, the mere mention of this demographic change can activate a kind of latent, perhaps deeply buried fear of status loss among many white voters, shifting them rightward in the political realm. And the second, I mean, I'm happy to go on.
No. Let's, sure. I want to dive even further into that, right? Because I think the second leg is even more fascinating to me as well. But white backlash is, I think, something that as progressives, we are concerned with. And I think a lot of the way, in terms of a policy perspective, I had Eric Levitz on a few weeks ago, writer for New York Magazine, he wrote a piece on this just about how kind of emphasizing the universality of programs that Democrats are trying to propose, as opposed to saying, well, this will help alleviate racism, even if that's the end, right? Even if that's the end result, or having even a more balanced approach in that area is super effective, and or maybe the way that we should trend towards. But you're talking about this more from just, I guess, the common, I guess, notion in Democratic Party politics that maybe they don't have to be, active in promoting their kind of policies because, these demographics are just going to shift. But really, that commonplace notion you're saying can cause some white backlash.
Absolutely. And I think for progressives, just to kind of build on what you were saying, is that it gives them or has given them a false sense of security, especially with regards to how to appeal to non-college white voters. And non-college white voters remain a sizable fraction of the electorate and will for some time coming. We're talking about, roughly speaking, 4 in 10 voters out there today. I think it convinces too many that there's no real need to appeal to the non-college white vote. that it's not needed because of our fast changing demographics. And underlying the kind of hypothesis is of the kind of coming majority minority nation is this idea that more minorities equal more progressives. And at least prior to the 2020 race, this was a conviction, I think, shared by many on the left and the right. And it does seem that it still retains its hold.
Right. So the second leg of the problems with this assumption is kind of just democratic complacency. You touched on the complacency about winning over the non-college educated white voter. But there's also complacency when it comes to winning over non-white voters. I mean, we saw this in the 2020 election when it came to Latino voters in this country and how Trump actually made some significant gains in that area. So I'm wondering if you could expand upon that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're still getting data out on this. The recent kind of high quality study I've seen is from the survey research firm Catalyst. They document about a 10-point swing in the Hispanic vote for Trump relative to 2016. So in 2020, it looks like about 36-37% of Hispanics voted for Trump in the presidential race. There was plenty of evidence that before 2020, that just because someone is categorized as a racial or ethnic minority does not mean that person's a leftist. And so in some ways, I think 2020 shouldn't have come as such a surprise as it did. And that kind of speaks to, I think, the third major problem with the kind of overall hypothesis of the changing demographic makeup of the country. And this is one that I kind of anchor the piece on. It's kind of based on this really wonderful new book by the demographer and sociologist Richard Alba. It's that the basic kind of empirical reality of it is wrong. That in fact, at least for a variety of reasons, some technical, some not so much, there's not actually much evidence out there that within a few decades, this is going to become a majority minority nation.
Yeah, so it could spark white backlash. It causes complacency in the Democratic leadership that already take, I would say, non-white voters for granted. And it's wrong. So those are just many, many problems with this whole majority-minority thing. Let's talk about why it's wrong, though. Why are you, I already know the answer because I read your piece, but if you could explain to the audience, why are you saying that it's incorrect? And of course, how does that have to do with ethnicity in this country?
Sure. So today, one in six marriages in the United States are between people with distinct ethnicities. That's been a kind of rapid rise over the last couple of decades, something that's been happening despite all the kind of top line headlines about cultural conflict, about, you know, all the kind of xenophobic political campaigns, anti-immigrant policies that we've seen implemented. And the children of these mixed ethnicity partnerships and the children of minority white partnerships in particular are the kind of pivot point upon which the majority minority hypothesis rests. In other words, only by classifying children of mixed parentage as minority does the transition to a majority minority society appear so imminent. And as I argued, this way of assigning people to various groups rests on a conception of race and ethnicity that's kind of borrowed from our pernicious and uniquely awful racial classification scheme where we categorize anyone with African-American heritage as African-American. This is a one-drop rule. So to get to this imminent reordering of our racial or ethnic hierarchy, you have to categorize the children of mixed partnerships as minority, which is what the census does. It's what it does to arrive at the highly publicized estimates that, for example, 2040 or whatever is the year in which whites become the minority. It's what the census did to arrive at the very highly publicized estimate that as of 5 or 6 years ago, the majority of babies born in the United States were not white. But leaving the babies aside, many of these children of mixed partnerships don't see themselves this way. Their ethnic identity is often fluid, context dependent, and in many cases symbolic, right? It's not a determinative factor of where they live, who they love, what schools they might attend, or to connect it with our current political situation, who they end up voting for.
Well, you're a sociology professor, so I'm wondering if you could connect this to the conception of race and the construction of it in this country. I know you touched on it a little bit there with the one drop theory, and which has been, you know, is a remnant of slavery, is an element of white supremacy. Can you talk a little bit about that and the kind of uniquely American perspective? I know, of course, there's anti-Black racism throughout the world, but specifically when it comes to our conversation surrounding this.
Sure. So longstanding system of racial classification in this country posits that the Black-white divide is binary, fixed, and largely immutable, and that despite a growth, you know, still small, but a growth in white African-American partnerships, the children of these partnerships are categorized, generally speaking, as African-American. You know, can just look at our former President Barack Obama. And that application of that system of racial classification to all other minority populations is what we do to arrive at this notion of a coming majority minority nation. But that's inaccurate in many ways. Many of the children of mixed partnerships are fully integrated in majority white institutions, neighborhood schools, friendships, romantic partnerships. In other words, as Richard Alba of other demographers, and as I kind of pick up on in the dissent piece, make clear, to use an old world word, they've assimilated, not in the sense of shedding all their kind of outward signs of ethnic heritage, not that, but this kind of new assimilation in the United States today, 21st century America, doesn't require losing all your ethnic signifiers. Today's mainstream does allow for cultural differences, does allow for kind of distinct ethnic identities that often accompany cultural differences, but it does imply a weakened connection between ethnic and political identity. I want to be very clear here. No one with a distinct ethnic identity is immune from slights, misunderstandings, all sorts of hurtful treatment. And again, to reemphasize, for certain minority populations, and here African-Americans stand out as the kind of anniversary of George Floyd's murder makes tragically clear, the boundaries constraining mobility and the boundaries kind of impeding progress on any number of fronts remain incredibly thick. But for other minority populations, what we've seen is kind of a rapid and upward integration. And that, I think, has real consequences and implications for political dynamics.
Well, it prevents the Democratic pollsters, the Democratic powers that be, from treating ethnic groups or even non-whites really as they're classified in the census and in, I guess, mainstream consensus as a monolith. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, I really want to expand on the fact that Black Americans really bear the brunt of a lot of this, and also just more about the kind of ethnic versus racial classification and the complete blending of those by the powers that be in a way that's, you know, just completely maddening. We'll be right back. So before we broke, we were really kind of just starting to dive into the way that I think, you know, ethnicity and race and the differences between the two are entirely conflated. That was the word that I was looking for before. And it's really interesting to me, I didn't know this before reading your piece, that a majority of Latinos do not see themselves as POC, as people of color. And that, you know, that's not going to be reflective in the data that the Democratic Party is kind of using themselves to soothe themselves to sleep. Like, yeah, we don't really have to provide Medicare for all or Green New Deal or fight for $15 minimum wage, right? Because we can just be passive in our own electoral success. This is what's going to happen. Just expand upon the difference in those identities and how that kind of informs our conversation.
Sure. Yeah. Again, to mention that, you know, with this huge, growing, and incredibly heterogeneous population that we label Hispanics or, you know, Latino, Latina, and oftentimes in political debates, this is a population that both gets categorized as leftist, or its growth is seen as, you know, delivering kind of a salvation for progressives. And that's, you know, 2020, I think, shook that complacency. As I mentioned, it shouldn't have been much of a surprise. As you point out, the vast majority of the population does not identify as people of color. We find over generations that the Hispanic identity, or for kind of Mexican Americans, the Mexican American identity tends to attenuate, especially for children of mixed minority white partnerships. You know, if you just look at various occupations today, over a third of Customs and Border employees are Hispanic. About a quarter of the ICE workforce today is Hispanic. This is a vast population with all sorts of political and ethnic identities wrapped up within it. And I guess one of the frustrating things is that in the aftermath of the 2020 vote, especially the immediate aftermath, it felt like we were all amateur anthropologists kind of sleuthing around various corners to discover why certain Hispanic subpopulations might have voted for Trump. But given the kind of story of assimilation in this country over the past few decades, that I think, and given how widespread, I think this is also important, how widespread the shift in the Trump vote was. It wasn't simply a story of one population, the Rio Grande Valley and Miami-Dade County, moving rightward. Given it's how widespread it was, I think we ought to look elsewhere for that explanation.
I mean, is part of that very complacency that we're warning of? I mean, there was some data that I'm going to butcher now, but that showed that essentially the Trump campaign had spent a lot more money on Spanish-speaking ads, I guess, proportionately than the Democrats did in the presidential race. I mean, could this very, you know, central thesis of this conversation, could that be the cause of some of what we're seeing on the electoral level?
I think so in some cases. And again, not I'm not a political strategist or anything close to it. So in terms of kind of electoral strategies, it did seem from an outsider's perspective that complacency probably was part of the issue. Another part of the issue that I think gets lost in a lot of the debates is that, as kind of I calculated, and I was surprised as well, that nearly 9 in 10 of the Hispanic electorate didn't immigrate from anywhere. They were born in the United States. And many of them speak English. I mean, I would say the majority of them speak English. And so kind of the targeted Spanish language advertisement would, I think, have its most direct appeal within kind of majority or kind of a dominant immigrant communities. And so what I try to argue for is that in many cases, instead of searching around for ethnic specific explanations for Hispanic voting behavior, for other ethnic voting behavior, you should probably focus on the key variables that pattern politics among whites. And what we know, and everyone agrees upon, is that the urban-rural divide looms large, and the education divide looms increasingly large as well.
Yeah, I that sounds like a foreign concept for a lot of people in Washington. But there's also an inherent racism to that, like that divide too, where there's, you know, this mythology surrounding the Rust Belt white voter that I think a lot of you know, Democratic pollsters and powers that be have kind of sold themselves while completely dismissing non-white voters and treating them as a monolith, as we keep talking about. But I wanted you to expand upon this concept of an ethnic option, because I want to return to how Black Americans really bear the brunt of a lot of this whitewashing, for lack of a better word. How an ethnic option is available for some and not for others.
Right. It's a great question. So what we know is that as the kind of, you know, as the second and third generation of many immigrant communities, or, you know, past immigrant communities, begin to integrate in key institutions, right? Begin to marry white individuals, begin to partner with individuals of other ethnicities. they retain their ethnic identity, but it becomes optional in some ways. It can be expressed in certain contexts, not in others. It's not determinative of what we would term their life chances. It's not determinative of what schools they'll attend. It's not a determinative factor in where they're going to live in terms of their neighborhoods, what their friendships are going to look like, what types of jobs they are going to get in the labor market. It becomes in some ways an optional ethnic identity, somewhat analogous with some differences to the kind of attenuation of white ethnic identities in the kind of early post-World War II decades, right, where you had the kind of expression of Irish Americans' pride and heritage and Italian American pride and heritage. Those identities over time became key to people's sense of self, but didn't become determinative, but lost their kind of determinative power in shaping where those individuals were going to end up in life. And the key divide here is the African-American white divide. That option, that symbolic ethnicity, just is not available for the African-American population. Here, we have not seen the progress that we've seen in terms of integrating other racial and ethnic populations. And here's where both in politics or across a range of other institutions, including education, our neighborhoods, our labor markets, where segregation longstanding entrenched inequality remain all too often the norm.
Can you talk about how this hypothesis also completely erases class from the equation? I mean, you mentioned it earlier in your suggestion about how we should be looking at this instead. But to me, that's one of the more egregious elements that we haven't yet really expanded upon.
Sure. So if your kind of operating assumption is that the growth of the minority population equals the growth of the progressive population, or at least the Democratic population, you are assuming in some ways that the kind of varied class backgrounds of tens of millions of individuals residing in the United States are not key factors structuring how they're going to think about politics. And as we know, that's just wrong. That, again, we're talking about, in the case of Hispanics, we're talking about roughly 17% of the U.S. population today. We're talking about everyone from the bottom to the top of the class ladder, with all of the kind of key ways in which we know class, especially in interrelationships with educational attainment, pattern who you'll turn out to vote for on election day.
Yeah. And lastly, I guess I'm wondering if this reliance on what, you know, the Democratic Party sees as kind of the inevitable demographic trend has been informing their trend towards appealing to upper middle class suburban whites along the coasts. Because even if the Democratic Party still appeals to a percentage of white voters, they're becoming increasingly concentrated in blue states and in upper class voting blocks. So, I mean, one, they're kind of basing their electoral future, if they have a long-term strategy, on these demographic trends that, as you have pointed out, are myths. And also an unsustainable class message or focus on appealing to wealthier white voters. So I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I hate to end on a real pessimistic note, but I think my frustration with so many of these conversations has to do with what seems to be just a kind of basic fact of the electorate that's overlooked by many strategists and others. And it's that, well, if you look at 2020, 44% of the electorate self-identified as white and didn't have a college education. And that's huge. That's not going away anytime soon. And it means if you were going to cast that category or cast that group aside, or at least not try to make some marginal gains, it just means that wide swaths of the country, upper Midwest, for example, are going to be extremely difficult to hold or make any inroads. And And you're going to have to just run up the score, as you mentioned, among the kind of upper middle class professionals that oftentimes live in or around the nation's cities. And again, you know, none of us chose the ordering of our demographics across this huge landscape, but it is what it is. And if that's going to be kind of your anchor and the extent of where you're really going to maintain, be competitive, you're in for some trouble.
This is actually the last question. Do you think that broad social policies that alleviate suffering and expand the social safety net, do you think that that can be a path forward? Since perhaps we can end on an advice note, which is semi-positive.
Sure.
Do you think that that could be an antidote to some of these issues that we've been talking about today?
Yeah, I think so. I think the first solution I would have is easy, and it's stop talking about the coming majority-minority nation. It backfires, and it's wrong empirically, or at least it rests on a kind of binary fix and unrealistic model of ethnicity. But second, I think you're right. Amplifying those issues that have widespread appeal, including appeal to non-college voters of various ethnicities, is really crucial. And the good news here, if we want to end on a positive note, is that there are plenty of policies to choose from, plenty to choose from, ranging from raising the minimum wage, right, increase expenditures for infrastructures. You could go down the list. And really leaning into those, I think, is probably our best bet going forward.
Absolutely. Jake Rosenfeld, professor of sociology at WashU St. Louis and author of You're Paid What You're Worth and Other Myths of the Modern Economy. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Hey, are you still subscribed to the free show? Well, head over to ROFpodcast.com and hear what you've been missing. You become a member, you're getting our bonus material every week. And we're going to add to it, too, going in the coming weeks. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And don't forget, you can check out my daily show, which is co-hosted by my colleague on this program, Emma Vigeland. Every day at noon, we stream live, and then it's later available as a podcast. For Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.